This podcast is brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Keep Joy on air by becoming a member, a subscriber, or donate. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.
Welcome to The Informer, Joy 94.9's nightly news and current affairs program, and your link to the stories that matter. We are committed to bringing you the day's most important news and current affairs stories from an LGBTI perspective. If it matters to the LGBTI community, we will cover it. We want to hear from you. Join the conversation, SMS 0427 Joy 949 or email onair at joy.org.au or follow us on Twitter at The Informer Joy.
It's Monday the 26th of June. Welcome to your nightly news and current affairs show, The Informer. I'm your host, Shannon Power. On tonight's show, we will look at the 20th anniversary of the release of the Harry Potter books and the impact they have had on the world's LGBTI community. And later on, we'll talk to longtime marriage equality advocate Rodney Croom. He'll tell us if we should be getting excited about leaked comments from Christopher Pyne, saying he believed marriage equality would happen sooner rather than later in Australia. But first, we're going to head over to the Philippines, where it has been revealed LGBTI students face a concerning amount of bullying and discrimination. Human Rights Watch last week released a 68-page report which documents the range of abuses against LGBTI students in secondary school. It details widespread bullying and harassment, discriminatory policies and practices, and an absence of supportive resources that undermine the right to education under international law and put LGBTI youth at risk. Ryan Thorson is a fellow in the LGBT rights program at Human Rights Watch and joins us on the line from Manila.
Ryan Thorson from the Human Rights Watch, thanks so much for joining us on The Informer. Now, you've spent quite a bit of time in the Philippines studying the impact of, I guess, discrimination and against LGBTI young people in that country. It's a very extensive report that the Human Rights Watch have released. What were the results of it that surprised you?
I think the most surprising thing for me is that the Philippines has really been a leader in combating bullying against LGBT kids. It was the first country in Asia to adopt an anti-bullying law that specifically prohibited bullying on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. And so we were expecting to find some forms of discrimination and exclusion that we'd heard about from activists beyond bullying. And one of the most surprising things was that bullying still remains rampant. Many of the folks that we talked to in schools, people like teachers and administrators, either weren't aware that LGBT kids were covered under the anti-bullying law or knew that they were aware or knew that they were covered but hadn't adopted sort of policies to make sure that students were aware of that fact. And so that was frankly surprising that the law's implementation hasn't necessarily made a huge difference for children on the ground.
So does that mean that perhaps there's been a gap between changing the laws to prevent discrimination against LGBTI people and then perhaps the communication of what those laws mean at the ground level, at the coalface, at schools?
Yeah, I think it really illustrates the gap that can exist between achieving legal protections and then enjoying legal protections. And for so many people involved in LGBT advocacy, winning these legislative victories really is a struggle. And there's a tremendous amount of work and energy that goes into passing a law. And in the Philippines, but certainly in other contexts, you really start to realize that passing a law is a first step rather than sort of the end of the process. And so in the Philippines, at least, the passage of the anti-bullying law was a victory and has had meaning for some students. But there are a range of sort of implementation challenges that we speak about in the report that still merit attention and need to be addressed.
What are some of those challenges?
So some of the challenges that arise from the anti-bullying law are really about awareness. There are things like training teachers to be sensitive to LGBT issues, to know the terminology, to know where to point students if they're experiencing bullying. Some have to do with training teachers to be aware of bullying generally. Teachers may know that bullying is not acceptable, but they may not know how to intervene if they sort of witness bullying happening between students or what to do if they see a colleague bullying a student. what sorts of things beyond physical abuse might constitute bullying, things like that. And then on the level of government implementation, one of the difficulties with the anti-bullying law has been data collection and monitoring. So it isn't clear how many schools in the Philippines are adopting their own sort of anti-bullying policies at the school level that specifically spell out that bullying on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity is wrong. And then there hasn't been data collection to sort of say, you know, when students are reporting bullying, how many of those cases are, because they're LGBT, were those cases addressed in a satisfactory way? And what sort of protection is given to LGBT students who do report bullying?
So give us an idea from when the laws were changed in the Philippines. How long has it been since the laws have been changed?
The Department of Education enacted a child protection policy in 2012 that basically is an administrative policy saying that schools should, take action and report on incidents of violence and bullying against children. And then the Congress in 2013 passed an anti-bullying law that prohibits bullying on a range of grounds, one of which is bullying on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So 2012 and 2013 was really sort of this key moment in fighting bullying in the Philippines. And there's been some, implementation of the policy since then. But it's been slow enough that the Department of Education had to issue another memo in about 2014, 2015 that, said schools really do have to begin implementing this, and implementation has still been slow since then.
There are some recommendations in this report about implementing the law more effectively. What are some of those recommendations you've made?
Yeah, so one of the recommendations is just to conduct an audit of the schools that the Department of Education oversees, which are both public and private schools in the Philippines, to see what kinds of policies they're implementing. And that recommendation stems from the fact that some teachers and administrators had essentially just adopted these templates prohibiting bullying from the Department of Education website without necessarily doing the kind of teacher training and sensitization that makes them effective. And so, they'll sort of copy and paste the Department of Education's policy, but they won't read through it to understand how it actually should apply in the school and what sorts of things they need to be doing to monitor bullying. Another recommendation is to collect statistics on bullying and discrimination against LGBT youth in schools. So there is a spot on the sort of standardized form that the Department of Education issues that says, was this gender-based bullying? But there's a lot of confusion among teachers about what gender-based bullying means. Some people sort of don't read into it and don't understand that it includes LGBT youth and not just, youth based on their sex, whether they're male or female. The data that they collect on bullying and how many people are bullied each year on those forms hasn't been made public, and so it's not clear to advocates, how widespread is bullying? Are people reporting bullying? To sort of develop action plans to actually address it in a concrete way. So those are two of the recommendations. And then we have other recommendations related to things like discrimination and access to information resources in schools, encouraging the Department of Education to take some first steps on those issues as well.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9, and we're chatting to Ryan Thorson from Human Rights Watch. They've just released a massive report revealing the levels of discrimination and bullying that LGBTI students face in the Philippines.
So I'm interested to know, you have this list of recommendations. Does the government engage with you, or the Ministry of Education? Do they then engage with you to take on these recommendations, or have you found that they're resistant at all to listening to this kind of feedback?
The hope is certainly that the Department of Education will engage. And, that's always the ideal when we do these reports and reach out to government offices. We did send the Department of Education a summary of our findings and recommendations and a request for a response back in May, and we haven't heard anything back from them since then. So we will obviously sort of reach out with the full report and make sure that the various sort of figures and undersecretaries at the Department of Education are aware of the report. But today's launch was helpful in the sense that, someone attended from the Office of the Secretary of Health. There was a statement from the Vice President's office. There was a statement from the Commission on Human Rights. So there are other government agencies that have shown a willingness to engage and really address discrimination and bullying against LGBT youth in their capacities. We're still reaching out to the Department of Education, though.
Do you put a time frame on when a more effective implementation can happen of this anti-discrimination policy in Filipino schools, or is it just put it out there and start engaging with the right stakeholders to make it happen, and it will hopefully happen when it does?
Yeah, so we timed the launch both to coincide with Pride in the Philippines and also to coincide with the beginning of the new school year. And as students are returning to school, you know, the hope is that soon schools will be thinking about what their policy should be for the following year. And it gives us time to engage with the Department of Education, but also potentially with school administrators to think about how their schools could be made more safe and inclusive for LGBT youth in the year to come. So there's not a sort of definite timestamp on it, but the idea is to sort of start the conversation early in the school year so that we can implement some of the policies that are going to be rolling out over the next academic period.
So Ryan, aside from the anti-bullying aspect of your investigation, what were some of the other things you looked at in this report?
Yeah, so, you know, we asked students what the problems were that they were facing in schools, and bullying was one of the issues that came up. But there were two others that seemed especially striking. One was discrimination against LGBT youth sort of writ large in schools. And one of the things that seemed to be the biggest barrier to access to education for LGBT youth were uniform and hair length restrictions. And so even in public schools in the Philippines, it's typical that you'll have uniforms that are gendered, male and female, and then also hair length restrictions where, you know, young men have to have short cropped hair and young women can't have hair that's shorter than a certain length. And the idea behind those policies is to sort of promote discipline and to promote a sense of, you know, cleanliness and orderliness at the school. But for transgender youth in particular, students describe being stopped by security guards at the gate if they weren't complying with the gendered requirements, being taken out of class. One young woman reported that she was brought in the office and punished with a disciplinary infraction because their handbook listed an act of effeminacy as a sort of disciplinary matter in the school. And so as a transgender girl, she was basically punished for being effeminate in school. And so those sorts of things really do throw up a big barrier to the right to education for LGBT youth in the Philippines. Another area that we looked at that LGBT youth had considerable difficulty with was the lack of resources available in school. So, you know, students would say that LGBT issues were almost never covered in the curriculum. And when they were, it was often very negative messaging. So things like, you know, being LGBT is wrong, being LGBT is sinful, sort of overtly religious messages about being LGBT that really sort of chilled student expression and led to bullying by staff and faculty. In addition, very few of the students that we spoke with had access to things like supportive counselors or supportive teachers that they could turn to if their home environment wasn't supportive or if they were experiencing bullying. And at the high school level, at least, there still hasn't been a deep interest in LGBT student groups, what are often called like gay straight alliances in other parts of the world, even as these groups have become really popular in the Philippines at the university level. So at the university level, you know, people are finding them very helpful. Students are organizing, they're getting involved. But at the high school level, it still can be very alienating to be an LGBT student in the Philippines.
You're listening to The Informer on Joy 94.9, a show bringing you the day's news from an LGBTI perspective. If you've been on Facebook today, you might have noticed people declaring their allegiance to either Ravenclaw, Hufflepuff, Slytherin or Gryffindor. They're the houses at the Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry, the imaginary school in the Harry Potter series of books. Harry Potter fans are celebrating the 20th anniversary of the release of the first Harry Potter book, which was called Harry Potter and the Philosopher's Stone. The book would go on to become the first of a multi-billion dollar book, film and theatre global empire. The Harry Potter series has inspired a devoted legion of fans, especially LGBTI fans, who love the boy wizard who would go on to save the world from the evil Voldemort. The Informer talks to two Harry Potter fans about what the books mean to them and queer people. Liam Esler is the GX Australia game developer, and Jemima Skelly is a Sydney-based writer and Harry Potter super mega fan who has gone to some extreme lengths in her love for Harry Potter.
I was actually living in New York when the last film came out. So a bunch of friends and I, we kind of went to the premiere. We were there the night before. We camped on the side of the road. Probably we were there for about 20 hours lining up to be at the front so that we could see the stars walk down the red carpet. And that was pretty exciting. So we saw, first of all, Tom Felton came past and he signed my book.
Wow.
And then also Ron, what's his name? Rupert Grint. We saw Emma Watson and then a few of the other cast members. I got to see J.K. Rowling, didn't get to talk to her or anything, but I saw her and that was enough for me. I nearly cried.
Both Esler and Skelly believe Harry Potter was formative in their lives and they're not sure they'd be the same people without
it. I love the idea of, you know, sort of waking up one morning and finding out that you're special and you get to go off to this awesome place and make amazing friends. At the time, I was, you know, struggling in school and being a gay kid growing up in a country town, didn't really know anyone else who was like me. And, you know, I struggled with feelings of loneliness and isolation. And so the idea that one day I could wake up and my queerness would be like this awesome thing and I'd have all these friends was really appealing at the time. Plus, J.K. Rowling stories are amazing and hilarious. So it was a lot of fun as a kid.
Yeah, definitely. I honestly think I'd be a completely different person if the books hadn't had such an impact on my life. It's taught me to be kind, I guess. It's taught me the importance of love and the importance of friendship and the importance of just being yourself, really.
LGBTI fans are some of the biggest consumers of Harry Potter. They were really excited when author J.K. Rowling even revealed Hogwarts principal Albus Dumbledore was gay. Esler and Skelly explain why Harry Potter is so important to LGBTI people.
Yeah, it's really interesting because, you know, in the books there aren't really any out gay characters. Obviously Dumbledore's gay, but it's not revealed. It's not revealed in the books at all. It wasn't until afterwards that J.K. Rowling confirmed that. But I think it's just the message that the books kind of send to the reader, which is that everyone has a right to always feel included, no matter where they're from, no matter their background, no matter what they like doing, no matter what, everyone has their own place. And I feel like, for me, that's the message that I took away from the books. And that's, you know, the message that I carry on in my life.
For me, I think that it was the fact that the idea of sort of wizards and muggles kind of was an allusion to queerness and heteronormativity. And although I didn't really understand it at the time, you know, there was a link that I was making between those two things. And I think that a lot of other people sort of felt the same way. Like a lot of people were isolated or felt really different to other people. They were, you know, a different group and weren't accepted in the rest of the world. And so the idea of Hogwarts is a bit of an escape from, you know, that idea of heteronormativity and normality, somewhere where you can be accepted for who you are and go and, you know, explore your identity and these amazing powers that you have. And I think that that's very appealing. Plus, for me, I mean, the Harry Potter and Draco Malfoy fanfic was really just a draw, so.
Today's anniversary marks 20 years since the Philosopher's Stone was released. Esler and Skelly reveal their favourite moments from the Philosopher's Stone.
I think it was one of the, like, so the Philosopher's Stone was one of the first times that I'd seen a female character in a book sort of take on such a major role in that way.
Like Hermione?
So my favourite scene... Yeah, Hermione. so my favourite scene was right at the end of the book when Hermione basically saves everyone's ass. And she's this incredible, kick-ass, nerdy girl who saves the day through her wits. And that was something that I hadn't really encountered before. And I really loved that. That was really cool.
That's a hard one. Probably my favourite moment is when Harry first enters Diagon Alley. It's almost, it's his first encounter with the magical world, and it's also ours as the reader's first encounter with it as well. And, you know, he walks down that street and it's described so well. It's so visceral. It's like there are sounds and like smells and things he sees, and it's just like a really great portal into the magical world for the reader.
And the all-important question, to which house do they belong?
The house that I'm in would definitely be Slytherin.
not a lot of people can come to terms with the fact that they are Slytherins. For, you know, the uninitiated, that's the house that Lord Voldemort came from. But, you know, there's certain, I guess, positive characteristics about being a Slytherin. Why are you out there proud Slytherin?
Because I think that, you know, as much as the Slytherin house is about, you know, evilness and, or it's portrayed that way in the books, like, there's this sense that Slytherins are very intelligent and smart. They are, but in a very, very different way from Ravenclaw's, which is the traditional smart house. They're very, very loyal to their friends, and they value friendships incredibly highly, almost over everything else. And they're very ambitious. They have big plans. They like to strategize and spend a lot of time, you know, devising strategies to get what they want. And that sort of hits home for me in all of those cases.
I'm a Ravenclaw through and through. I've thought it from the beginning. I've done every test under the sun, and I've always come out Ravenclaw.
You're on The Informer on Joy 94.9, Australia's first gay and lesbian radio station. Christopher Pyne had many people in Australia excited today when leaked audio heard him saying he believed marriage equality would happen sooner rather than later in this country. Pyne made the comments at a factional Liberal Party event in Sydney on Friday. Marriage equality advocate and Just Equal spokesperson Rodney Croom joins us on the line to tell us what Pyne's comments mean for marriage equality in Australia. Rodney, welcome to Joy on The Informer. You've been a long-time marriage equality advocate. What's your take on the leaked comments by Christopher Pyne?
Well, I find it encouraging that Christopher Pyne is saying that there's movement on marriage equality within the Liberal Party. It's not a big surprise. I think if you've been watching the issue closely, you would have seen supportive Liberals like Tim Wilson or Trent Zimmerman or Dean Smith indicating that they're interested in moving the issue forward in this term of government based on the recommendations of a Senate inquiry that came out in February. So it's, to me, what Christopher Pyne said is, to me, confirmation that there is still movement happening within the Liberal Party. And I hope that after the winter break in August, we'll see, at least see a bill tabled and hopefully see a debate in the Liberal Party room on a free vote, which is what's necessary to get this through.
So do you think there are Liberal Party members and politicians at the moment who use this winter break to perhaps rally some more troops and get the issue moving forward by the time August comes around?
Yeah, I hope so. I hope they're using the time to look at what kind of legislation they would want to move forward, and also, as you say, rally the troops. One of the problems that we've had up until now is that moderates in the Liberal Party who support marriage equality haven't really done the best job of doing the numbers in their party room, of making sure that there's the support there to have a free vote on this issue. And they really were outmanoeuvred in 2015 when the party room supported a plebiscite rather than a free vote. I'm hopeful that that won't happen again, and that this time they'll be able to get the numbers there in order to move a free vote forward and to ditch this ridiculous idea of having a public vote on marriage equality.
It seems as though Christopher Pyne did backtrack on Twitter today, and with the statement his office released saying that he's, you know, the party still supports the plebiscite idea. Do you think that he's just trying to put out a fire within his own party, or what do you think that public statement from him means?
Well, it is still the government's policy to have a plebiscite. And it may remain so, but of course that doesn't preclude private members introducing legislation or crossing the floor to vote for it, or the party room revisiting the issue and saying, we're done with the plebiscite, we'll have a free vote instead. So I don't see Christopher Pyne's a tweet about, you know, affirming the policy of a plebiscite really as a backcracker. I still think that there's ways that the issue can move forward in Parliament after the winter break, and I'm still hopeful that it will. I really don't want to wait until the next term of government. I think we can achieve marriage equality in this term of government. There's a lot of pressure that's being applied to the government at the moment, not least from those by those opinion polls that show that it will lose seats and potentially lose government based on this issue, because there are so many people who are just so sick and tired of this issue not being resolved and want the government to do it as quickly as possible.
So it would almost seem like a smart political move for Malcolm Turnbull to now act on the issue based on those stats. But from an advocacy point of view, what does your organisation and yourself do now over the course of this parliamentary winter break to make sure that when they come back in August, this issue does get put to Parliament and hopefully gets over the line?
Well, the key to moving marriage equality forward are, as we've been saying already, those moderate Liberals who support the reform but can't yet vote for it. And what we'll be doing over the next few weeks, as we've done over the last few weeks, is put pressure on those Liberals to actually take action. They can't go to the next election saying simply, oh, well, we support it, but we didn't have a chance to vote for it. That won't carry any weight with their voters. They need to be able to say they did everything they can to make sure that they have a free vote. A plebiscite policy will not carry any water. It won't assuage those people who are just really sick and tired of this reform not being enacted. And there, I'm not just talking about LGBTI voters. I'm talking about young people who really want to see this reform occur, the family members of LGBTI people, and they're right across the country. In those marginal seats where we have Liberals who support marriage equality, they can't afford to go to the next election with nothing having happened. And that's the message that we'll be ramming home to them over the next few weeks, encouraging supporters of marriage equality in those electorates to email them, to visit them, to go in and say, hey, look, you've got to do more than you're doing now. You've got to get a free vote, you've got to vote for this, and you've got to resolve it before the next election.
Okay, Rodney Croom, hopefully after the winter break we might see a lot more movement on marriage equality. Thank you so much for your time here at Joy, and we look forward to speaking to you again soon.
Thanks, Jen.
That's it for another episode of The Informer. We'll be back tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. to bring you the day's big news. A podcast of tonight's Informer will be available to download soon at joy.org.au or on your preferred podcast platform. We'd like to thank tonight's guest, Liam Ensler, Jemima Skelly, Ryan Thorson and Rodney Croom. My name is Shannon Power. There's more Informer tomorrow at 6:30 p.m. Coming up next on Joy 94.9 is Matt Renwick with the news, followed by Outtakes.
Thanks for listening to another Joy podcast, brought to you by Australia's LGBTQIA+ community media organisation, Joy. Help us keep Joy on air. Head to joy.org.au. Joy, a diverse sound for a diverse community.